Probably be tired by 45 minutes, so, there it goes. Okay, I'm Judith Marti from Anthropology at CSUN, and this is
Denine Montoya. I was a former boycotter in San Jose for the Farmworkers Union, and my family was one of the first three families to live at what later became La Paz. So,
and your main job was organizing the boycotts?
Well, back in the mid-60s, women did not leave their families to go do political things, at least most women that had been mm-hmm. raised in the Midwest mm-hmm. With a 50s mentality. And I had two small children and a husband who was Mexican. And I remember when Viola Luzio and Michael Schwerner and I can't remember his full name, but I think it was Goodman, mm-hmm. the Freedom Riders, were killed. Mm-hmm. And I cried because I wanted so badly to be on those marches and to be there. And in the 60s, a woman couldn't articulate that to her husband and say, mm-hmm. I want to leave you for a while. I want to leave my children. Mm-hmm. I want to go do this political thing. And I don't think he ever heard about it until in 1982, we put a book together at the 20th anniversary, and I articulated it in my memories in that book. But it was just unheard of. I mean, there was just no way mm-hmm. I could bring myself to say to him that I wanted to do that. So my family...
How old were your children at that time? About?
Well, 4 and 6 years old.
Oh,
something
really small.
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. My family, I grew up in Missouri. Mm-hmm. My father was a military man, and he and my mother were divorced when I was 6 years old, and she remarried into a German Lutheran farming family. My stepfather's grandfather had started the banks in several small farming towns, and he mm-hmm. owned the grain elevators. Mm-hmm. And controlled the fate of a lot of farmers who borrowed from the bank and everything. And of course, I wasn't aware of this as a child. And I was not accepted into that family because my mother had been a divorced woman and they were devoutly Lutheran. But nor was I allowed to associate with children on a lesser social level. So I felt pretty isolated, you know. Mm-hmm. They were members of the Farm Bureau, of course. I later became a great embarrassment to them. But my mother had always been interested in politics. I remember when the Army McCarthy hearings were going on, mm-hmm. since she was an Army brat too, you know, she really had some definite ideas about what was going on there with the House Un-American Activities Committee, and I grew up with that kind of conversation going on. My stepfather, being a religious man, talked a good case about civil rights. I don't know that he practiced it mm-hmm. in real life, but he talked a good case. We'd just come out of the Huey Long era, you know, and populism was a very mm-hmm. popular thing. And so I had an uncle that was on the city council in Kansas City and had been an undersecretary of the Navy for Harry Truman and a great friend of his. And when he broke away from the Pendergast gang, it was on all the network news because mm-hmm. he won, and probably with the help of the mafia on the north side, but, mm-hmm. you know... So politics were, the family was involved in some sort of way in democratic politics, and there was liberal thinking going on. So mm-hmm. After I married my husband and we moved to California and John Kennedy decided to run, I did do precinct work, but from my home. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of telephone work and so forth and so on. And then after his assassination, in 1968, when Bobby announced, we were just absolutely thrilled, and I got involved in Robert Kennedy's mm-hmm. campaign, as did my husband, and again, a lot of precinct work and so forth and so on. And after his assassination, well, actually, the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated, we were registering voters at King and Story Road in mm-hmm. Salsipuedes in San Jose when the riots broke out. And I had one last person I was registering, and I was bound determined I was going to get that form filled out so this person wouldn't lose their right to vote, and bullets were whizzing all over, you know. And eventually, you know, they were pulling the table out from underneath me as this guy was signing. But then the next day we came back into the area, and we were told by the people who lived there that they knew that we were there supporting the farm workers, you know, and Robert Kennedy, mm-hmm. and that they actually had been protecting us unbeknownst to us, and that we were in no immediate danger. So that was awesome, I thought. Wow. Anyway, after Bobby was assassinated, Caesar sent various people from the union to communities and to see if some of these Kennedy workers wanted to redirect their energies. And Dr. Jerry Lackner at that time was his doctor, who lived in San Jose, and Caesar sent Lupe and Kathy Murguia and Susan Drake, mm-hmm. who was married to the Reverend Jim Drake from the California Migrant Ministry, his first two Anglo volunteers, mm-hmm. to San Jose to try to recruit some of us. And some people put their energies toward the peace movement, and some people right. decided to go work on the anti-gun thing, and mm-hmm. some of us decided that the farm workers' cause fit our beliefs.
Why did it fit yours? Because of your background with farm work?
I don't know exactly. My husband was Mexican, but it wasn't because of that. Mm-hmm. You know, we had sort of followed in the newspapers the early mm-hmm. struggle, and mm-hmm. we certainly were sympathetic. And I don't know, it just seemed a very comfortable thing, and it seemed to be what we wanted to do. So,
and a right cause.
Yeah. And again, at that time, mm-hmm. a woman raised in the 50s to be a housewife and mm-hmm. mother, it was impossible to think about me going out on a picket line. So my husband and two other men.
Your children were older now.
That was 1968. Okay. So John was 5 years old.
So not that much.
Scott was eight. Okay. And so my husband and two other men mm-hmm. took turns each weekend making picket signs in their garages. And then these guys would go out on Saturdays and Sundays and picket Safeway all by themselves. There was no one doing any activity in Santa Clara County. And so for the first year, it never occurred to me that I could go out on a picket line or send my children out there. Uh-huh. I mean, it was just, it didn't even enter my thoughts. Mm-hmm. And yet I was very proud of what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he'd come back with stories about people pelting them with grapes and all this stuff. And mm-hmm. so about a year later, Caesar sent Frankie Rodriguez to San Jose to open a boycott office. And mm-hmm. I suspect he knew nothing about our activity, you know. Mm-hmm. And when we found out about that, I had some secretarial background, and so I did say to Reuben that I really felt that I could contribute in a secretarial way. I mean, that was okay. Women could do that. And so it was okay as long as I went during the hours the children were in school, and I was free to pick them, be home when they came home from school, and I most definitely had to be home to fix his dinner and take care of him, and I couldn't slack any of those duties. Well, then as I got more and more involved, you know, my days were getting longer, and I wasn't driving. He was dropping me off on the way to work and picking uh-huh. me up on the way home. And I got more, and I said, well, wait, you know, we have this, or there's a meeting, you know, why don't you go get the kids and come down? And he started getting a little resentful, you know, because uh-huh. my attention was being drawn away from the family. So I thought, I've got to figure out some way to involve him so that he gets off my back. So I remember one day I said to him, you know, we need some fundraising things. If I cut out these little red pennants, do you think you could silk screen some little black eagles on them, and maybe we could sell them at the rallies? Mm-hmm. And he didn't even know how to work a silkscreen. He went out, and he was in an illustration department. He set up the art department at Westinghouse on Hindi Avenue, and so he was a wonderful illustrator. And so he researched how to best do the silkscreening, and that was when they first came out with the process where you could actually take pictures and you could transfer it to some kind of gel that would come on the silkscreen and make the thing on the silkscreen for you, so you could almost do like photographic reproductions. That was very new at that time. Anyway, so, God, we need thousands of these little stupid pennants and put them on little sticks, you know, and we sold them for a quarter a piece. And so then he had the idea of doing T-shirts. No one was silk screening T-shirts. It had not happened. And he, whatever our rally was, he would silkscreen something to put on there, or he would put the union label on there, or whatever, and we started selling T-shirts. Mm-hmm. So then he had the idea of buying the blue chambray field worker shirt and silk screening the union label on the back of it. And so we started selling those. And then because of his artistic ability, you know, we Liz Rodriguez, whose children were involved in El Teatro Campesino, well, actually at that time, El Teatro de la Gente, they were, it was the beginnings of the Chicano movement, and they were young people in college, and they were involved, and so she started thinking of all these buttons and things and posters and stuff, and some of which Ruben helped with, some of which the students did. And so we wanted to do some buttons, and Ruben did the research and found that there was only one guy making buttons, and he was in Berkeley. His name was Bob Rush. And so we would go up there with the art renderings, and then he would turn them into buttons, and we would turn around and sell them. Well, pretty soon we were making enough money to pay for the Huelga office and all our expenses, and we had some left over, and we were sending it down to Delano, and all of a sudden Caesar's ears went up, and Pete Velasco's ears went up, and we started taking food caravans down and clothing donations, because part of your work in the boycott is to go out and to talk to house meetings, to spread the word, and leaflets, and we made up leaflets all the time, newsletters, and we went out and we talked to union groups, we went out and talked to the Central Labor Council, we talked to political groups, we talked to anybody, student groups, anybody who would listen to us. And my biggest memory is running down the street with just scads of leaflets in my arms, you know, and maybe Dolores Huerta running beside me and saying something to me in Spanish, and then the light bulb would go on that I didn't understand a thing she had said, you know, and then she'd say, oh, you know, one of these days, sister, you've got to learn this. And I knew cooking terms wonderfully. I mean, I can cook in Spanish. I just can't speak in Spanish. So first time I saw Dolores was during the Viva Kennedy campaign in East San Jose, and we had an office there, and with Ernie Abetia, who was Caesar's compadre, and I had heard about Dolores Huerta, you know, for a number of years, and the public image of her was this woman that got up and spoke in a very powerful manner, you know, and that she was a very forceful person, and so I was waiting all morning for this woman to come in. And you know, people came in and drifted in, and this little mousy woman was standing over in the corner, you know, and she asked me for a glass of water, and I gave it to her, and I was thinking to myself, where the hell is Dolores? We've got this rally coming on, you know. The rally started, and this mouse got up and roared. I mean, I could not believe it was the same person, this unassuming person, you know, who...
Just has such a presence.
Yeah, and Dolores has been an example to me as to what a woman can be. You know, she made sacrifices. A lot of times her children were raised for periods of time by other children. They went through a lot of bad verbiage that was said to them about her, and because she totally dedicated her life to this movement. And there was many a time during the start of the militant Chicano thing, you know, where we would hear the term Chicano power, Chicano power, and a fist raise, and Dolores would always look at me and very quietly say, people power, sister, people power. I think she did more for the liberation of women in her own quiet way, though for those of us who knew her well.
How?
Just by her example. There was a time in the union when things were very, very rough for her, and I'm not going to go into the details as to what was causing this, but it was quite a time of turmoil for her. She had been beaten up, and just a lot of things had been going on, and at that time, her youngest daughter, Peanut, was youngest daughter at that time was staying with me at La Paz, and she would come up and visit Peanut, and I remember her sitting at my kitchen table, just during the worst of all of this. And I said to her, God, Dolores, how do you do it? How do you take all this stress, you know? And she just very quietly said, I have great faith. I pray to the Blessed Virgin whenever I feel it getting to me, and my faith sustains me. And these are not words that anyone would expect from Dolores, you know? And it just blew me away, you know? To me, she was my shining example of what a woman could be and keep her femininity and still be strong and not strong in the sense, a negative sense, but be able to set boundaries, mm-hmm. to know what her sense of purpose was, mm-hmm. and what her focus was, and not lose sight of that, mm-hmm. and not be intimidated. And that was just unheard of in those days. Just absolutely, I mean, she had an absolute sense of who she was, mm. as Caesar did, mm. you know, as Helen did, as many people, at Pivelasco, you know.
And she couldn't have done it without women like you who would take care of her children.
I really wasn't the only one. There are a lot of people in the union, you know, that the children stayed with.
The women helped women in everything that they did.
I remember one time, you know, Peanut was crying because some people had said some very cruel things to her about mm-hmm. her mother. And I remember Reuben and I sitting her down and talking to her and saying, you know, you're young now and you don't really know everything that's going on, but you may not believe this, but there's some people who think your mother is a saint, you know. And we explained to her that what she was doing now, you know, was very necessary, and sometimes mm-hmm. it meant being away from the children, but that her love for them never, ever wavered, and it didn't. And you look at her children now, and mm-hmm. they're all achievers, you know, and they all think the world and all of their mother, you know. Mm-hmm. And it shows what a single woman can do with a career, and still maintain the respect of her children, and mm-hmm. they can grow up to be contributing adults themselves, mm. you know. And to me, she's my shining example. Her daughter, Lori, much to my surprise, and I don't suppose it had anything to do with me personally, it's just that she liked the name, but she did name one of her children after me, so that's something I'm very proud of. Mm-hmm. What was it that came to mind was... Oh, another thing, you know, you were asking about the role of women. Women served. There were women out on the picket lines. It was the men whose pictures were taken.
That's right.
Unless women were being arrested, you know, mm-hmm. or beaten up. I don't think a lot of focus was placed on the individual women who contributed. There were women, my girlfriend Gloria Soto, mm-hmm. who I think only had a great school education. Grew up around Delano somewhere. Her name is not Soto now. I think Naranjo is her name now. She worked in the service center. She worked helping people with immigration. She did everything that anyone could possibly do in that service center. Hiring hall, any aspect of it. And she was so knowledgeable of the law and how to help the workers. She eventually became director of the clinic operation in Tijuana, mm-hmm. and the field office in San Ysidro. You know, and then she eventually went to work for CRLA and left the union. But I looked at Gloria. I mean, here was a girl who worked in the fields as a child, whose family had always worked in the fields, who mm-hmm. had very little education. And this woman has more knowledge than I'll ever have in my entire life, you know. She's incredibly intelligent and made a heck of a contribution. There were people like her everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, Helen and Caesar setting up a credit union by ordering books from the U.S. printing office and studying it, learning how to do it, you know. I mean, they weren't rocket scientists, mm-hmm. but they did it. They did it. One of my fondest memories is any time that we would have a rally, we would have a mass, and the women would have baked the bread to share in the mass. And it was such a feeling of brotherhood and sisterhood and such a feeling of community that to this day I have a problem going to the institutionalized church for a service, because there's ritual there and there's beauty, but there's not that feeling of connection, that feeling mm-hmm, of brotherhood and sisterhood that we felt in those things.
Religion seems to be very strong in this union. Certainly Chavez talks a great deal about how important his faith is.
It was indeed, and I think that the fast. We were talking about this morning at breakfast. The fasts that he went on, I don't think were primarily intended as a public thing. you know, to prove a point or anything. He told me one time that he actually could think clearer, you know, when he was on a fast. His mind was not jumbled up with a lot of other things, and to him it was a very spiritual thing, in the same line that it was for Gandhi. You know, mm-hmm. he was a great student of Gandhi's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I think there were a lot of churches, Protestant churches and Catholic churches, you know, who supported us. There were a lot who didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, religion, and you know, in all the marches and everything and the rallies, you will see a banner of the Virgin of Guadalupe there somewhere, mm-hmm. usually in the front, and somehow all this tied in together. And part of it was cultural, you know. But I did see, and I think what faith I have is a very internal thing now, rather than an outward thing. And because of the things that went on and things that we experienced, and it's a very peaceful, serene type thing that has nothing to do with fundamentalism or mm-hmm. trying to convert other people mm-hmm, or that sort of thing. It was a very private thing. For it, you know. So yeah. What else can I answer for you?
There's no questions I can ask. You're wonderful. You're just giving me so many stories, and I'm getting a real insight into the movement, because I've read not nearly as much as I should, and I'm continuing to read mm-hmm. The events, but it's mm-hmm. it's the people and mm-hmm. the events that made the events. And
people that were there every day. One of the most rewarding things for me in coming here this weekend mm-hmm. is Carlos invited me to speak to two of his classes. Mm. And this indeed is what I had requested rather than sitting on a panel, because one of the things that happened both at 40 Acres and at La Paz is mm-hmm. when students came in, after the regular work hours, we would either sit down in someone's house or in the cafeteria or Filipino mm-hmm. hall somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and we would just sit and talk.
Now, the students came from where?
A lot of them came from universities all over the mm-hmm. United States mm-hmm. for short periods and long periods, as long as 3 months sometimes, mm-hmm. and they were getting credit, you know, in humanities departments for doing this. And there was just a lot of discussion going on and a lot of exchanges and them wanting to find out about us and us wanting to find out, you know, how their heads were working and to mm-hmm. show them what we were doing and what the cause was all about. And in this, our children were always present, and they were never treated as children. They were treated as another person who was there. If they felt like asking questions, if they felt like contributing, they did so as much as any of us. And I think by osmosis, it was the best education mm-hmm. a kid could ever have.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have all the wonderful toys and things that other kids had. They had each other. It was just wonderful. And you look at the, I call them my Welga babies, and you look at these kids now and see what they're doing. They're like the adults who have left the union. These people didn't stop participating in their communities mm-hmm. wherever they were. Some of them are more active than others.
Mm-hmm.
But the stories that I've heard this weekend, you know, of what people are doing now, it's just absolutely thrilling, because they're still out there carrying mm-hmm. this vision mm-hmm. that one person can make a difference. And they're still out there dedicating their lives to making changes. And our children, just in the small group that was at La Paz, we have one that is a gourmet chef that could serve in any hotel in this United States. We have lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
We have doctors.
Mm-hmm.
My own two sons, one is, his work is sponsorships. He goes out and he gets people like Southwest Airlines and so forth and so on to contribute money to community events, sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the San Jose Jazz Festival. We've been involved in multicultural arts activities in San Jose. I say we, I mean, they do all the work. Scott, because he grew up in the Union and knew Luis Valdez and Agustin Lira when he was a little boy. Eventually, sat on the board of directors of El Teatro Campesino. Mm-hmm. Luis took him under his arm and taught him so much. My son is a wonderful illustrator, had mm-hmm. his own business at that time. Scott now is a producer for Paul Rodriguez Productions. Mm. I look at how these kids have educated themselves and what they've gone out and accomplished, and the wonderful thing that came about for the children, I think, is never at any time did they not have a sense of who they were. Well, my generation mm-hmm. wasn't really sure.
Sure,
you know.
That's right.
And these kids absolutely knew by osmosis what their rights were. Wonderful story.
Okay.
Wonderful story. In Keene, we had a little school that went from kindergarten through third grade, and my youngest son went there. The older children were bused into Tehachapi. And we didn't have any teenagers at that point. I think the oldest child probably was in eighth grade, and this included the Zermenos, the Anzaldúas, the Vasquezes, the Murguias, the Montoyas, and the Chavezes. Mm-hmm. And one day the kids came to us and they asked for a meeting with the adults in the administration building. So we went, and they right off the bat said they had a problem, they had defined the problem, they knew the solution to the problem. They wanted to do the work, they just wanted to tell us what it was they wanted to do, and they were asking for our support. And so we said, you have our support, and we went with them. And what happened was they went to the school board, mm-hmm. the Tehachapi School District. We walked into a meeting, which just shocked the socks off of the board, and these kids presented their case that according to federal law, the school lunch program was not to differentiate between children who paid for their school lunches and those who did not. And it had come to their attention that those who paid for their lunches were getting hot lunches, and that those kids who were getting it free were getting cold box lunches. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to point out to the school board that they were in violation of federal law, and if it didn't stop, they would be reported to the federal government and they would lose their funding. And they were so articulate. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. Blew me away. And they won. And from that point on in Kern County, uh-huh. kids who didn't pay got hot lunches too, thanks to this little handful. The Drake kids were there too. Susan Drake's kids were there too. There was a time at the Tehachapi School District where every morning the kids would get up to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And Matthew Drake, who was in fourth grade, mm-hmm. refused to stand up. And the teacher asked him why. And he said, I'm not going to stand up until my black and brown brothers are as free as I am. Kid was in fourth grade. You know, the teacher called Susan and complained, and Susan said, well, so? how can I argue with that? He's right. You know, I support him.
These were the lessons they were learning, the important lessons in life.
Yeah, and I mean, they just mm-hmm. absolutely were so politically hip at those ages where I was playing with my dolls at that age. They've always had a sense of who they are and what their rights are. And I think, if anything, one of the many things that have come out of the movement is a whole generation of people who now know that they don't have boundaries, mm-hmm. that they don't have to sit back and take certain things, that they do have rights and how to defend themselves and say, basta, enough.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is not going to happen anymore. And this is why we have wonderful weekends like this weekend mm-hmm, now, mm-hmm. you know. But it came from a whole mentality, and it was an evolution. And I just look out and see where all these people are in the different communities in the United States and how they're still working and what they're doing. And it's just, it's unbelievable. I'm awestruck. I'm awestruck that somehow, in some small way, I could have been a part of any of this. It just absolutely amazes me. I mean, I was a little kid from a farm in the Midwest, you know. Who would have thought?
Well, that's why I asked you how you got involved.
It was because, you know, Caesar sent and recruited.
But you had already been involved.
You'd been involved
in politics to some degree, yeah. So anyway, when we started bringing in all this money, then Caesar, I guess, sent word through Elizabeth that he wanted to meet us.
Mm.
And so we started going down on the Friday night meetings and taking food and clothing. So then Caesar had this idea. I guess up until that time, I don't know what they were printing the El Macriato on, but it wasn't like a full-fledged print shop. And I guess very often they had to go out and depend on other sources for printing the thing. And because Reuben was an illustrator, because he was, at that time he was working at Space Publications in Palo Alto, and he was the head of the illustration department, Caesar thought that somehow Reuben would be the one to go out and research the presses, research how to set up this print shop. And at that same time, the prior of the Franciscan Seminary in Santa Barbara, which is adjacent to the mission, but is definitely separate from it, had decided to close down the print shop and had donated their presses and all their equipment to the union, until some of the more conservative Franciscans, and especially Archbishop McIntyre, who were not favorable to the union, threw a big fit, and so the pressure was put on him not to give it to us. So what he did to compromise is he sent the entire print shop to the Franciscan Communications Center on Santee Street in Los Angeles, and he sent Reuben there with it, and Reuben was in charge of running that. In the meantime, Reuben was running all over the state, you know, looking at different presses and finding out the dimensions and coming back and reporting to Caesar, and Caesar couldn't make up his mind. I don't think that's what I want, you know. And so for a whole year and a half, I sat up at La Paz, and Reuben was either in Santa Barbara or Los Angeles. In fact, the day the presses were moved, Reuben had come overnight to La Paz, and we were sleeping in this really tall, narrow hospital bed because I had just gotten out of the hospital with the union disease, the back problem, and that earthquake struck, and we were holding on for dear life to this bed to keep from getting thrown out on the floor, and in my case, from thrown out through the windows that were right there. And we really thought that the earthquake was just local until we turned on the TV and saw. And then Reuben says, "Oh my God, the presses, they're somewhere between Santa Barbara and Los Angeles." And he couldn't get through Highway 99 because south of Gorman it was closed. And so he did get through Ojai and Santa Paula and Oxnard. And he went down through the slides and through the coast and through Santa Monica. And as it turned out, the presses had just arrived in Los Angeles and probably were still on the truck, and so they weren't hurt. And so that was just a little side story. But at one time, Caesar thought about putting me and the kids at the seminary, you know, so the family could be together, because I was complaining that, hey, this is really tearing my family apart. And I went down there, and I saw these two rooms they were going to stick Reuben and me and two kids and a dog and a cat in, and all these Franciscans were having heart attacks because some woman was going to be on their property eating meals in their cafeteria, and I just told him, this is not going to work, you know, it's not going to happen. So the separation of families because of the boycott, because of where various members were sent, was very, very hard on families, and it's one of the things that's not talked about very much, and something that one of the students asked me about in the class that made me stop and think about. It's kind of something we swept under the rug. You tend to hear about all the ideal things that happened, and like you said, like the dates and the highlights, but it took a terrible toll on families. You know, human beings are human beings, and if people are away from their families, they find ways to be mischievous and to mess around, and things happened, and there was a lot of heartache. There were people who died. There were marriages that broke up. A lot of heartache. A lot of heartache. But I think in all this heartache, no one ever lost their focus. about why they were there and what they were doing. I think sometimes, not in all cases, but in some of the families where it was the pressure of just having different activities to do and mm-hmm. being separated from one another. In some cases, the problem was that one spouse was not as committed as
right.
the other. That happened as well. I mean, there were all sorts of reasons.
But then the women had the children.
The
so
women had the
added,
children. But we were still expected to work. We were still expected to work. I think that a lot of people, and I think...
What about you? Now, you had when your husband was away then a great deal of time and you had the children, what did you do? Because you weren't home with them all day.
I was, well, you know, they went to school, therefore I was the only adult female on the property at that time who drove a car, who didn't have little tiny ones to look after, mm-hmm. and at that time there were members of the John Birch Society and Teamsters coming up during the day in rented cars that all had the same license plate holder from a rental agency in Bakersfield, but no license plate.
Mm-hmm.
And they would shoot guns off around the houses.
Oh.
And so I would, like...
That's terrifying.
Crazy. We had no security. And I had no good sense. And so I would jump in my car and I would chase them. And the minute you would become visible and chase them, they were gone.
Now, this is when you were...
At La Paz. Yeah. And Kathy couldn't go because she had babies in her arms. Anita couldn't go. She had babies in her arms. You know, Mike Krakow was underneath the building trying to fix it somewhere, you know. And that was before anyone else moved up there. And I'll tell you, it was scary. It was really scary. And then there was the bombing of 40 Acres.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone came by and strafed Caesar's house in Delano. And then somewhere in all this period, the FBI contacted us. Caesar called a meeting for those of us at La Paz. They had already told the people in Delano that they played a recording for us of a contract being put out on Caesar's life. It was a grower's son, you know, up north of Delano somewhere. I don't even Tulare somewhere. I don't even remember where the guy was from. He left the country. But there was a period of time there where Caesar was running for his life, and he slept in a different place every night. And often he would come to La Paz, and there would be meetings up there. And since his secretary Susan was in Delano, sometimes I would be secretary. And I often wondered, you know, I was such a low person on the totem pole, what the heck I was doing listening to all this really heavy duty, you know, union decisions and stuff. And I didn't know why I was there sometimes. And I remember one time, and I won't go into specifics, but there was just a really heavy, heavy discussion going on in Caesar's house, and it was about 1:30 in the morning, and it occurred to me, you know, I'm nobody. I shouldn't be here. I should be hearing this stuff. This is really internal stuff going on here. And so I got up, and I was trying to sneak out. And in the middle of his heavy discussion, Caesar's total voice changed, and he turned to me and says, "Where are you going, sister?" And I said, "Well, I really don't feel like I should be here, you know, that I belong here. This is really heavy-duty stuff, you know, and I was going to go home." And he looked me right in the eye, and he says, "You belong to this union, don't you?" And I said, yeah. And he says, "Then you belong here." And that, again, just blew me away. You know, it gave me an insight, you know, the way he was thinking and how he valued each of us. He was, when he died, I was working at a company in San Jose, and a friend called and told me, and I just totally broke down at work. And I worked for a bunch of Germans. They didn't know what the heck was going on, who he was, you know. And I couldn't wear a Welge eagle in my German office, you know, because they thought it was a Nazi symbol. You know, anyway, I remember saying to my boss at the time, I said, "I just lost my best friend." And I think the mark of the man is that each and every one of us whose lives he touched felt that he was our best friend and that we were his.
It was a special trait of his.
A special trait. When his mother died, and Susan asked me to, I would have gone anyway, but I mean, she asked us to go together to Juana's funeral. We walked into our Lea Guadalupe in San Jose, and the things hadn't started, and we were just looking for a place to sit, and Caesar came out of the sacristy, and he just held his arms out to me, and he just enfolded me in his arms, and he said, I knew you would come. You know? I mean, who was I? I was nobody. You know?
Well, that's not
But he and I had a very wonderful, special mm-hmm. relationship, mm-hmm. but I'm not unique. Every one of us felt that way.
Well, each of you is unique.
Yeah. But we all felt that way, you
know?
And I think that speaks more to him mm-hmm. than it speaks to us.
Mm. Yeah. So let me see how we're doing on this recording. Let's go back to the little and see. This is...
Well, you know...
It gives such an insight into the lives of the people who were part of it, because mm-hmm. I remember you were just saying, you know, I wasn't unique, but it looks like there were so many of you and that you were just one, but when you really count them up, yeah. They're not that many of you in the whole population, and it's incredible, not just the dedication, but the persistence. I mean, you kept at it, no matter what.
Well, there was the focus, you know, and we had this common goal,
mm-hmm.
and maybe that's what's lacking nowadays, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When the Vietnam War was going on, there was a common goal there for the
mm-hmm.
people that were involved in
mm-hmm.
that, and it brought people from all walks of life,
mm-hmm.
you know, who maybe necessarily didn't get along in everyday life, but they had this common goal.
They could put those aside.
And I think that was the important thing. I just thought of a little story that... when the volunteers would come in for the Friday night meetings and the food caravans and so forth and so on, Pete Velasco, who was the vice president of fundraising,
mm-hmm.
To me, this is one of my best friends and a saint. I mean, I just love Pete. He always had a smile on his face, and they called everybody brother and sister, as all the Filipino brothers did. His belief was that we don't let anyone sit around. You know, we will have tasks mm-hmm. for them, to involve them, to mm-hmm. make them feel that they're making a contribution. And one day, I worked primarily for Pete when I was in Delano. And so one day he brought me this lady.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a kid with her, and who probably was about 10 or 11 years old. And to this day, I can't swear it was a boy. You know,
mm-hmm.
but I kind of think it was, you know. Anyway, this lady was not coming from a healthy place. And, you know, we worked from 6 in the morning to 6 in the evening, and then we'd get off and we'd go join people at Filipino Hall at 4 at the, you know, wherever we ate,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then we'd have the Friday night meetings. Anyway, it's like I couldn't wait for 6 o'clock to get out of I was in this closed room with her, and I was... showing her how to fan out envelopes and stuff them and seal them and,
mm-hmm.
you know, just whatever needed to be done, put stamps on them and everything. And I can't tell you anything specific, but you know how you feel sometimes when you're around someone that's not operating in a really positive sense?
That's right.
And
very depressing.
There was just a bad feeling that I was getting. Bad feeling, and you know, and I felt like I was walking on eggs, you know, not to upset her or anything. And I can't say that she did anything overt.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This was a gut feeling. So when I came out of the room and I directed her where to go to eat and where they could lay their sleeping bags and everything, and I told her goodbye, at the time I didn't remember who it was, but I found out at Caesar's funeral that it was Gilbert Flores that was guarding, and I said to the guard, I said, you know, I think you want to keep an eye on this woman. There's something really wrong here. I don't know what it is. I can't tell you anything specific,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but something's really wrong. And I think it was within 2 years after that,
mm-hmm.
or maybe less or time, imagine my surprise when I saw Sarah Jane Moore arrested for trying to shoot President Ford. And I went, oh my God, I mean, I got goosebumps all over me.
Oh.
And it wasn't until Caesar's funeral and Gilbert and I were talking And Gilbert said they had actually escorted her off 40 acres that night because her behavior got more bizarre and more bizarre, and they felt that she was a threat to Caesar.
And she was.
She probably was.
Wow.
Hi. And you need something? No.
He's checking.
And I asked Pete, you know, at Caesar's funeral if he remembered that, but he saw so many volunteers, he really didn't.
But you had that feeling.
Oh, man. I saw that face, and I thought, oh, my God. You know, I was in this room all by myself.
That's right.
But so, you know, this brought an awareness to me, too, that people come to organizations, to movements, and while you all may have a common focus, people mm-hmm. bring their own agendas mm-hmm, sometimes mm-hmm. and they're hidden.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's my firm belief that people come to movements and get involved in organizations, and I don't mean this to sound in a selfish way, but for the brown stamps that they collect out of it, for it either makes them feel good in some capacity mm-hmm. or they don't stay. And this may be a healthy capacity, maybe an unhealthy capacity. And the reason I bring this up is one of the questions that was asked me in the class mm-hmm. by one of the students was, well, was everything like Mary Poppins and really wonderful all the time? Or did you guys ever fight with one another? And did you hold grudges? And do you still hold them? And I thought to myself, you know, it's, and I did say to him that it's like any business, it's like any group, any organization. Mm-hmm. There's going to be people that become your best friends, and there's going to be people that you do not see eye to eye with, and maybe I don't like the way you combed your mustache today, mm-hmm. and so therefore you're asking me for money for shoes for your kid. I have the power to say no, sucker, mm-hmm, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there was petty things that went on, and there were some really hard ideological fights that went on,
mm-hmm.
but in the end result, we were able to keep our focus, you know? And despite these differences, I mean, it would be debated, it would be argued, and sometimes in a very heated mm-hmm, manner,
mm-hmm.
but we would come to a consensus. If we didn't, those people left, you know? They left. And some people left very bitterly, and I remember one time, I don't even remember why Reuben was mad, but it was after he came to live at La Paz, and being out, and he held Caesar in a very ideally in his heart. He was our leader. He mm-hmm. was God, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you tried to tell Reuben that you had this little problem or this little personality thing or you mm-hmm. you disagreed with something that was said, I mean, he couldn't handle it. He was shocked, you know, and you don't argue with our leader. In fact, one time he told me when Caesar went to jail in Salinas and Caesar was mad because we were there because we weren't supposed to be there because another couple was supposed to be there and they had not done their job. And mm-hmm. so he was really mad. And it wasn't that he was mad at us. He was mad that this, and I had this ongoing discussion with him about this couple saying, you know, I think there's just some people you can't organize because they have their own agendas. And he mm-hmm. kept saying, no, I'm going to organize them, you know. And we came out of there and Ruben said, you can't argue with him like that. You know, he's our leader. And I said, bullshit, I can't. That's why we have such a good friendship. That's right. Why we like each other, because we have this give and take. And we can do that. And I realized that I had something very unique there that he didn't, because Caesar always said, I don't want people to put me on a pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a human being. I have faults, you know. Don't put me up on the pedestal. If I die today, this union should be able to go on without me. And if it doesn't, I have failed. You know, and Reuben, so he was upset for whatever little petty bullshit that had happened at La Paz, mm-hmm. you know, and he was incensed, and we were going to pack up our things, and we were going to leave in the middle of the mm-hmm. night, and I said, well, you know, why don't we talk to Father Duran, you know, maybe we should talk to the priest about this, and Father Duran gave us some of the best advice that I've ever had in my life, and I've used it many times. He said, never leave a thing because you're angry. Wait till the anger cools off and look at your reasons for why you want to leave. And if you still want to leave, leave then. Because if you leave in anger, you will carry guilt inside of you and doubts inside of you the rest of your life that you'll never be able to get rid of. If you let the anger go and you know your reasons for leaving, then you can leave in peace. And I just thought, God, that, you know, that made
so wonderful, yes.
Wonderful advice. And so, you know, eventually my marriage broke up. Eventually I left. Reuben stayed a year and a half after I did, setting up the print shop. He, within 2 weeks after I left, he, you know, was rooming with a volunteer and eventually married her. And she looks very much like me. I've seen pictures of her. I guess in the beginning people thought we were back together, and it was really funny, you know, because I was up in San Jose.
Do you think, you were talking about the pressures on marriages. Do you think mm-hmm. that had something to do with it, the pressures of your being apart? And
I tell you, absence does not make the heart grow fonder.
Okay.
And what happens is you grow in different directions.
And you do grow fast in this. I mean, this demands
yeah,
growth, doesn't it?
It does. And it demands that, you know, for someone like me who was terribly naive and mm-hmm. who had always been told what to do and told I was stupid and that I mm-hmm. didn't have a mind of my own, all of a sudden I had mm. to start making decisions. And I was very ill-equipped for it. I was drinking mm. like a fish. I was drinking a half gallon of pink, Red Mountain Pink Chablis every other day, man. I was blotto. Susan Drake thought I had a nervous breakdown until she went through her divorce, and then she says, I realized you weren't crazy after all, you know.
Now, this is during your divorce.
This is while we were having the trouble that led up to the divorce, you know. And it was damn painful. I mean, it truly was. And for me, it was a cultural shock going in. And a cultural shock going out, and I had no base, I had no support system at La Paz. My one friend lived in Delano. Helen and Kathy were as supportive as they possibly could be, you know, they really were. They were good mm-hmm. friends, but I couldn't confide in them like I could in Gloria.
Okay.
And, but I had no family, I had no friends that I could talk to anyone about this, and so I grieved and I cried and I cried and I cried, and no one understood why this idiot woman is over here crying all the time.
Mm.
And Mike Krakow shared my duplex with me, and after Reuben would leave, you know, Mike had a drinking problem, and but Mike loved me, and I really loved him. He was a good friend, and he would come over and sit at my kitchen table, and he'd say, you know, these walls are really thin. You know, I love your sister, you know, and, but even him.
Now, this is when you left, now you're talking about Delano.
No, this is La Paz.
This is still La Paz.
La Paz. I never lived in Delano.
Oh, okay.
That's I never lived in Delano. We'd go down from La Paz for the Friday night meetings, or we'd come from San Jose to the Friday night meetings, or when we were still in San Jose and coming down, then we stayed with the Farnsworths, or we stayed with the Drakes, or we stayed in Filipino Hall. That's where Scotty met Richie Montoya. They were 9 years old, and Richie's dad would bring his family from Sacramento, and they found out their last name was Montoya, so they used to go around saying that each other were brothers, you know. And now look at Richie now, a culture clash.
So do you then see, because you're talking about how when you first came into the movement, you weren't used to making decisions on your own. It was like many of us, you believed in the woman's position as being secondary, and do you think that your growth then during this was one of the things that you would think is the most important thing that was happening to you? What do you think the most important, what did the union do for you, do you think? What were the most important things that came out of the union for you?
For me personally. Well, I look back, and I feel very privileged to have been a small part of making history. It gave me focus in a political sense. It certainly exposed me to other people and other ideologies. It gave me the opportunity to listen and to discuss, you know, with other people events that were happening in our lives at the time, some of which I agreed with, some of which I did not, you know. And I mean, I met people who were communists, who hated my guts, who thought I was a hunky little bitch from the Midwest, you know. And I won't name names, but and I had never met a real life communist in my whole life, you know. People who were proud of being communists, you know. And I met so many different kinds of people, and I think that it was a growing up. To me, it took. I was pulled dragging and screaming into being a responsible adult. When I left the union, I was 37 years old. Mm-hmm. Until that time in my life, I had never heard my parents say they loved me. Mm. You know, I had been raised in an isolated situation on mm-hmm. a farm. Going to college was traumatic for me. It was cultural shock, mm-hmm. you know. I tended to see things in terms of black and white, you know, with no shades of gray. One of the things I learned that there are mitigating circumstances, there are shades of gray. Mm-hmm. You can't just put labels on things and expect them to stay in those little boxes, mm-hmm. you know. It was a time of becoming aware. Mm-hmm. As a human. And even though I didn't have the strength yet to stand up for myself and my beliefs, the beliefs were being formulated, and there was a lot of internal dialogue going on in my mind. You know, mm-hmm. I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of listening. I was very privileged, I think. I mean, there are a lot of people in Delano that really resented those of us in what they called our little ivory tower up at La Paz. The whole idea that the union had bought Stony Brook was resented by a lot of people, and I think maybe it was a mistake, because it eventually isolated the union from the heart of its origins. You know, maybe it should have gone to 40 acres, and 40 acres should have been developed what the original dream was, you know. I think it, the geological separation caused ideological separations that might not have happened. I understand the idealism of it. In this tape, have I gotten into Caesar organizing Helen into living at La Paz?
No.
In the 30s and 40s, well, actually up until the time Kern County closed this place and we eventually ended up with it, it was the Kern County TB Sanitarium. Mm-hmm. And it's 10 miles south of Tehachapi on Highway 58. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's where it's located here in California. The union tried to buy this property, and Kern County would not sell it to them because the growers brought influence not to do that. So I can't remember his name. I can't think of it. John somebody. Was a producer of a movie called Grand Prix, and he was a supporter of the union. So he bought the property, mm-hmm. and then he sold it to us for a dollar. And there was nothing Kern County could do about it. In the 30s and 40s, it was a practice in the school systems that if the teacher spotted some kid that they thought might possibly have been exposed to TB, they would just take them away from the families. And, you know, they would explain in English to the families why they were taking them, but the families didn't understand English. Mm-hmm. And so all they knew that their children were being kidnapped, all the kids knew, is that they were being pulled away from their parents, and sometimes with cousins and sisters and brothers, and sometimes not. And they were incarcerated at Stony Brook. And the North Unit, which we later called Frankenstein's Castle because it was so scary. Now, if you can imagine, the trains that were later stopped that came from Sacramento to Los Angeles came through the San Joaquin Valley, came through Bakersfield, came up through Lamont Arvin, and there's a tremendous grade. They would have to use two engines to pull these trains up, and then it goes around the northern and eastern edge of the property at La Paz, and it through Keene, through the Tehachapi Loop, up through Tehachapi, across through Mojave, and through Lancaster and all that stuff, and then eventually into Los Angeles. Well, when these trains were being pulled up this tremendous grade, those tracks were right behind the North Unit where these children were incarcerated.
Ugh.
The first night I spent at La Paz, it scared me to death. It sounded like a banshee. The struggle of these trains trying to get up this hill sounded like a woman screaming.
Ugh.
And it scared me as an adult many years later. Can you imagine a child who has been wrenched from their family, who is in this institution, who's being cruelly treated, who nothing is being explained to them, they're possibly ill, and this thing is coming by a couple times a day, screaming like this, and in the middle of the night. These children, if they cried, they were beaten. They were given food that was unknown to them culturally. If they didn't eat it, or if they were beaten. If they threw up, they were forced to eat the vomit. I mean, the woman that was the matron, I understand, was just everything out of every horrible movie that you've ever heard, you know, of children being in orphanages. And it was just so traumatic for these children. Well, there were a lot of people in the San Joaquin Valley whose children ended up there, mm-hmm. two of whom were Sally Chavez and Helen Chavez.
Hmm.
So when Helen found out Caesar's idea of moving the union up there, she was so traumatized. Mm. And Caesar and I had an ongoing friendly battle. Again, my thing about there's some people you can't organize.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did I think he couldn't, I thought he shouldn't. And I thought it was, from my Anglo background, extremely psychologically cruel to force this woman to come up here and live here in this place that she was terrorized of. And I remember him telling me for months and months and months before she ever came up for the visit that, I'm going to organize her, sister. I'm going to organize her. She has to face her fear to overcome it. I believe this. And I said, it's cruel. It's cruel. Don't do this. Don't do this. And I was there the day that she came up. And I forget. Sally was probably there. I don't remember who all. It was just a handful of us and the guards, you know. And I remember walking from our houses. There's a path up by the water towers, and then you go down a little hill, and there's the swimming pool, and then you eventually walk around to Frankenstein's castle. And, you know, Caesar adored Helen. That was his princess.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so wonderful with her, you know, and he held hands with her, you know, and he talked her through it, and she got through it. And my God, look now that she's living up there, and nobody even thinks about that anymore.
That's an incredible story, though.
And I'll never forget that day. I'll never forget it as long as I live. I thought it was wrong. I thought it was the meanest thing I'd ever seen anybody do to anybody. And yet, the other part of that is he was very gentle and very kind with her, and he knew that she needed to confront this fear to put it out of her life. He was right. He was absolutely right. But in my Anglo culture, that was a very cruel thing to do. Very cruel. Yeah, so.
And what an insight.
Yeah, there's another time, you know, they'd have meetings late at night, and one night they broke up about 1:30, and Marshall Gantz was driving down Highway 58 back to Delano, and the ranch next to our property was owned by Alan Hale, the skipper from Gilligan's Island. And one of his cows got out, walked out on the freeway, and ended up going through the passenger's window, you know, front window of Marshall's car. So in the middle of the night, here's Lupe Murguia. He got the flatbed truck and woke up a bunch of volunteers, and they're out on Highway 58 hoisting this cow up in this flatbed truck. They threw it in the freezer, the locker, in the cafeteria, and the next morning he was out there butchering this thing. And he had a three-year-old son, Ricardo, and he insisted that Ricardo be there helping him. And I thought, I mean, to my Anglo culture, this was a very traumatizing thing. And I was Kathy Olguin and I were so angry at him, you know, for putting this child through. And this kid went around for days with his eyes big as saucers going, cow dead, cow dead, you know. And every time we'd go past Loopy, you know, we'd curse him, you know. We'd say, you asshole, you know. But in his culture, it was perfectly understandable. This was a way to make his son macho, you know. And it was perfectly acceptable from his culture and where he came from. In Mexico, there was no big deal. We were the ones that were making it the big deal, you know. And so
there were cultural differences.
Oh,
but you married someone from Mexico, so you
my husband was not from Mexico. His parents were from Mexico.
Ah, okay.
His and actually they came from the same town in Mexico, but his father was older than his mother and had fled Mexico because he thought he had killed a man in a barroom fight, and he fled to as far up in the United States as he could get. And to this day, I don't know if he was undocumented or not. And he ended up in Topeka, Kansas, working in the meatpacking sheds. And her family had migrated to Topeka at a later time, And even though they were from the same town and their families knew each other, they didn't know each other. And they married.
Oh, so he grew up in the United States.
And so he grew up in Topeka, Kansas. And he tells stories about when he was 7 years old going with his Sunday school class to the swimming pool in Topeka and the lifeguard pulling him out and throwing him out because he wasn't white and he was supposed to be in that same water with those Anglo kids.
Oh.
And he was clinging onto the chain link fence and crying because he didn't know why his friends could swim and he couldn't.
Oh.
When he was a teenager in Kansas City, he had this longtime girlfriend and they were necking out on the road or the lane of by her house, and the cops took him in and tried to get her to swear that he had raped her because it was wrong for a Mexican to be with an Anglo. After we were married and came to California, my stepfather's family, who had a lot of teachers and preachers in the Lutheran religion, we had his sister's husband was president of St. Paul's High School in San Francisco, Lutheran High School. And his grandmother was 94 years old and lived up in Santa Rosa and was coming down for a visit at these people's house. So I wanted to see her. I'd only seen her a couple times in my life. And so I sort of invited us up there, you know. And they were very wonderful and very gracious to us, and we had a wonderful time. And a couple of weeks later, I got a call from my mother in Missouri. The word had gone down to the grapevine of the family that I was never to bring that Mexican in their family again. After all, what would their parishioners think if they saw him with me? You know? So there was a lot of prejudice. There was prejudice on both sides. When I went down to Los Angeles, a surprise visit to Reuben, you know, when I was living at La Paz, I announced to him that, well, it's been a long time since I've been on a picket line. I really want to go out on a picket line tomorrow, you know. Will you take me? And at first he said yes, and then later he came back and he said, you can't go. And I said, can't? What's this can't, you know? And he said, I don't want my militant Chicano friends to find out I'm married to a goddamn Galacha. And I laughed and I said, you know, Reuben, a racist pig is a racist pig no matter what his color. However, I didn't go out on the picket line, but I got even because there was a rally in Delano sometime after, and the guy that was head of the Brown Berets that was just starting, his name was Danny something, and my name was Danny, and Reuben tried all day to keep me away from those people and keep them from knowing that he was married to me, and I saw him talking to them, and I went right up, and I stuck my hand right in that guy's hand, and I said, hi, my name is Danny Montoya, and I thought Reuben was going to faint, and I thought this guy was going to faint, you know, I mean, it was absolute silence, and I laughed. I mean, I got the biggest scare. I laughed, and I walked away, but, you know, I got it from both sides. He got it from the Anglo side.
But what about within the Union, though? Later on, there wasn't this distinction, was there?
Not so much. Not so much. I mean, if somebody got mad at you, you know, they might say behind your back, you know, gabacha this, gabacha that. I'm sure that people brought their prejudices to the Union. But it... Again, the common focus just sort of...
That's right.
And there were a lot of people whose lives that wasn't a part of, you know. That only really came into focus for me when the Chicano movement started. And I don't think that would have started if it hadn't been for the Union. I think because of what was happening with the farm workers, people began to see that they didn't have to be oppressed. And they began to see methods in which they could do something about it. They began to know that they had rights again, that they had boundaries, that they could set limits for themselves and limits as to what they would allow to happen to themselves. This may have eventually come about, but I think the impetus was what went on in the movement.
That
it
was
made
mentioned.
It okay.
Yeah, that was mentioned on the panel too.
Was it?
That's interesting that this was the beginning of the awareness. And that led to, because then some self-confidence came in.
And people were saying, enough, basta, enough. This is not going to happen anymore. And so, there's wonderful benefits that came out of this. Things that that we never could have predicted.
Right.
You know. Gosh, I know that there were other stories I wanted to tell you that, you know, your mind kind of wanders here.
Your mind is right on the button.
well, you, Go ahead.
I'll ask you some questions.
Sure.
So you left the union then, and why did you leave the union?
Well, Reuben had grown in a different direction, and he really wanted out of the marriage, and I think, again, didn't have the tools to know how to get out of it without a lot of guilt,
mm-hmm.
and had articulated that he really wanted me to go back to San Jose where my friends were, and let's call it quits. And there were points in there that I wanted to call it quits, but when it came down to the nitty-gritty of it, I felt like a failure, and I started clinging, and I didn't want to let go, and I didn't know how to let go, and I didn't have the tools to cope with any of it. So Caesar's sister, Rita, had been renting our house while we were down here, and I got a phone call that they had moved back to East San Jose, and, you know, the house was empty. So At New Year's, we had decided, well, we'd give it one last try to make a go of it, but within 2 weeks, we knew it wasn't working, and we got this phone call, so I went up to San Jose to get the house ready for new renters, and I got up there, and I was sitting with my friends down the street, and I could not go back. I couldn't do it. I called them, and I said, I can't come back. I'm not going to do it. You know, bringing my children, bringing my kids. I took a terrible risk. I could have lost my kids, you know. And it was about a month later that he brought them and a truckload of stuff, you know, whatever the volunteers hadn't raided. And, but I think, you know, it is my belief that everyone bottoms out at some time in their life. And from that bottom, there's nowhere else to go but up. My bottom, I can tell you exactly the night it was. I had stayed a couple nights with my friends, and I kept whining that I wanted to sleep in my own house. And my girlfriend kept saying, no, 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 there's no furniture, there's no heat, there's no electricity. You know, we don't want you to do that. And I finally borrowed a sleeping bag from her, and I said, I am going to do it when I need to. I woke up in the middle of the night with roaches crawling over my face, and my marriage a disarray, and I knew it was the end of it, and I thought to myself, I'm never going to sink any lower than this. From now on, everything is going to be up from here. So, to me, that was my that's where I bottomed out, was in that living room that night with roaches on my face.
And it's been up.
And you know, it sounds so very noble that we gave up so much and we sacrificed. And yes, we did sacrifice, you know. But I don't think that we were really consciously aware that we were making such a terrible sacrifice, because we were so focused on what we were doing.
And you were all doing it.
And we were all doing it together. And we had this common goal. And so I don't think we saw it as a sacrifice at the time. I mean, there was a time that the march to Calexico, we took a lot of materials down in the car trunk with us to sell, you know, and at the end of the march, you know, we did go across the border, and we came back, and I swear to God, every time Reuben was driving the car, the Border Patrol would stop us, because he was Mexican, and they would pull us over, and so they had us throw the trunk lid up, and we had all these buttons and posters and bumper stickers and things, you know, and this border patrolman says, you know, I never had one of those little flags. It was one of the little pennants. And, man, we loaded his arms up with shit, you know, and then he waved us on, you know. And we thought that was so funny because, you know, we had the idea that they really hated us and they were really against us. And this guy was just so anxious to get his hands on all the stuff, you know, the leaflets, everything, you know. He said, here, take it, take it. the march to Calexico, that was tough. That was while we were still living in San Jose, but we went down for that, and the air temperature was 106 degrees, and the pavement was 126, and they had the poo-poo trucks, you know, the flatbed trucks with the outhouses on them, and they would stop every so many miles, and the people would come back through the marchers with cups of ice and salt tablets. And in Calexico, we stopped for lunch, and I remember laying under the overhang of a school, and the person next to me, the way I shared a sandwich with, was Walter Mondale. And I had a Kennedy Action Corps button on. And he wanted to take it back to Ethel, and like an idiot, I didn't let it go, and I let it go to someone else who I know of never got there, you know. But then later on, the last 2 miles of the march, the celebrities from Hollywood came in to join us, mm-hmm. and I marched with Leonard Nimoy. And there was a little starlet that Reuben kept running into everywhere that I think he had an affair with, probably. He was Leslie Perry. She was a really cutie pie, so he disappeared for a while. And I ended up, at the end of the march at the park in Coachella, cleared the poopa trucks off the flatbed truck, and they put the crepe paper around it and the posters, and it became the speaker's platform. But those of us in the march, you know, that were really hurting, were underneath that truck, and the nurses were massaging our feet and taking care of the blisters and the first aid stuff. And this man sat down next to me, and he had a Stetson in his hand, you know, mm-hmm. and he had this Texas accent, and he says to me, "How far do y'all say you marched?" And I said, 20 miles. And he goes, "Jesus H. Christ." And he threw his hat over his face and just sprawled out on the grass. You know, he says, "I went 2 miles and I'm going to die." You know, and that was Senator Ralph Yarborough, who was the senator from Texas that was going head-to-head with Lyndon Johnson, mm-hmm. and was the whole reason that John Kennedy went to Dallas that day, because of their internecine fight.
Oh.
And when we went to do the memory book in 1982, we contacted people all over the United States, and he was one of the few who called me personally and talked to me for a long time about his experiences with the Union in Washington, and then dictated what he wanted to say in the memory book. And he remembered me. I could not believe it. I mean, it just amazing, totally amazing, you know. And he remembered Dolores so well. And one of the boycotters in Washington, D.C. had given him a ring, mm-hmm. A turquoise ring or something, taken off her finger and given it to him. And he had kept it all these years, and he was hoping I could tell him who that might have been. And he described mm-hmm. her, and you know, I've asked for years and nobody seems to know. But there's someone out there, one of us, who knows, that has that memory, that had that contact with him.
Well, if Kent starts the newsletter, that's a question that can go in the newsletter.
Yeah.
This can be a reunion newsletter.
Yeah. Huh. So, but that march to Calexico, it was hard, and I nearly got phlebitis. And I had my legs elevated for 2 weeks, you know, and ice packs and stuff. But it was worth it. I mean, I'm glad to say that. I'm so sorry I missed the march to Sacramento, because I didn't think that women could leave their families and go do that crap, you know.
You know, you mentioned about women not leaving their families, and then you tell me that you're, this is wonderful, that you, you'd leave at 6, and then, you know, work all day, and then you'd have the Friday night meetings, and then...
Well, this was the typical schedule for a volunteer if you were in Delano.
So you were working
at La Paz, though.
I see. That's
not
the difference.
Yeah,
that's the difference.
At La Paz, you know, I get the children ready for school, and there was nothing to do that first year and a half, mm-hmm. because there was no one else up there.
That must have been.
And so you asked me, you know, what I did. I walked every inch of that place. Found caves, dynamite caves up above the railroad tracks. We found the old abandoned reservoir that broke in the 1952 earthquake. One time Ben Maddock and I were walking up the mountain, and funny story, we decided to take a hike to go up to look at these caves, and I guess Scott saw us going up there, and so he and our dog but they were quite a bit ways down the hill following us, and they were trudging along, and the dog just stopped, and Scott looked up, and there was a cougar tracking Ben and I. And all Scott saw was us go over the top of the hill and the cougar go over the top of the hill, and he jumped over the dog, and they ran back down, you know, to the railroad tracks, and Scotty went to find Loopy, and he was just talking gibberish, you know, mm-hmm. "My mom's going to be eaten by the cougar," and Loopy's trying to get, you know, "What the hell's going on?" You know. And we came down a different way. We didn't come down the same way. So this kid was absolutely—he was in hysterics.
Oh, and then he doesn't see you.
Yeah, he was in hysterics because he thought the cougar ate us. You know, and Loopy thought it was really funny. You know, I was making fun of him. But then when I found out, you know, I felt so bad, because this little kid was just—he totally thought the cougar ate us. You know. But I sometimes they took my car, and in the winter I went out on the Mojave, and I found arrowheads, and I explored, and I went to the Silver Queen Mine, and went to Willow Springs, and went up to Inyo Kern, and you know, and I did a lot of walking in the desert, a lot of exploring. When the kids were in school, I always had to be back by the time that they got out of school. When Caesar was there, it was different. Then I had things that I could do, you know, secretary things I could do. When Reuben eventually moved up there and started an office in the administration building, there were things that I could proofread, and I still proofread scripts for Scott and materials for he and John. You know, to this day, I still do that. So basically, when I had time alone, what I would do is I would sit there and think up ideas for fundraising materials, because basically we came under the umbrella of Pete Belasco, and a group was formed called Tire Grafico, which meant the general store, as a vehicle to sell fundraising materials for the union. And so on Sundays, Reuben and Ben Maddock and Pete Belasco, Andy Zermania when he was there, myself, we'd get together over dinner, and then we'd throw out all these ideas that we'd come up with during the week. And you know, this button was this button was my design. And
I didn't know that.
I had this idea for it, and we didn't even know how to make one or if it could be made, you know. And Reuben did all the he did the artwork and did the research on it, you know, once it made it clear what I wanted. We voted on these things. There's a poster over in your picture gallery that we went to the other night that I remember very fondly, because we took this picture, and it was from the Gallo, when signing of the Gallo contracts. So Caesar's sitting in the fields, the grape fields with the workers. And I took this picture, and I knew I wanted these other words, and I didn't even know where it came. These words came from, but they were words of Caesar's. I mean, anything you saw was wordy, that was mine. And so I wanted to put that together with the picture. So Reuben did all the artwork necessary to get that ready for pre-publication, and that was like a 4 or 5 color poster. That was one of them that we put together and sold. A lot of ideas for buttons. And, wonderful story, when Caesar went to jail in Salinas, we wanted to put together some buttons to sell there. And we had a number of them, but one of them that Reuben did was a picture of Caesar with a white border, and on this border, the words, "Give 'em hell." Oh, God, Dolores was so mad at us for this. And Caesar was furious. He was absolutely screaming angry, because you don't focus on him. You focus on the movement. You focus on, the farm workers' strike, the grape strike. You don't focus on him. And he ordered us to get all these buttons together and go out and bury them at 40 acres. Well, we buried a shoebox full of buttons, but it wasn't those buttons. And we went out and sold the hell out of them. I mean, they were really a popular item, and we never told him. You know, we made a hell of a lot of money off of them for the strike, you know.
So that was, is that what Kent was talking about? You ran the print shop and
Reuben,
the illustrations.
Reuben did all the research for the presses, for all the equipment for the print shop. He learned how to use presses and how to become a printer, in addition to his skills as an illustrator who did all the prep work up to the printing. And in the building of the print shop, and he got those presses in place, he organized it, he did the Macriato for a while. I believe some other volunteers came in right after I left, and that basically happened right on the cusp of when I left. You know, that finally came to fruition, and there were people like Blaise Bompain and some guy who did a movie called Fighting for Our Lives, and you know, the film part of it started coming in, and those things started being developed. But that print shop, like Kathy and Helen and I laughingly call it the Reuben Montoya Memorial Print Shop, you know. Reuben, when he left the union, was very angry, as happens to a lot of people. And when we did the 20th anniversary memory book, I called him and asked him if he could do a poster for us, and he refused to do so. He was still carrying that anger 10 years later. I think now he's mellowed more about it.
What was his anger? Do you know?
You know what? I think at that time, Anna Pohorich had come from New York, And she was acting as Caesar's administrative assistant. A lot of people didn't like her. I never really had any direct dealings with her. I think I finally met her at Caesar's funeral. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people didn't like her. And maybe it had to do with the fact that they knew that she had a lot of money and, you know, she was another Anglo coming in, you mm-hmm. know, taking over an administrative job. But Caesar had a theory. He always had these administrative assistants that told people the bad news that they didn't want to hear coming from him because he didn't want to be the bad guy. And he laughed and he admitted this,
uh-huh,
you know.
Uh-huh.
And so I think that Reuben needed a light bulb for their apartment or something, or
uh-huh.
some kind of very
little, uh-huh.
stupid supplies. And she looked at him, didn't like him that day, and said no, you know. And they actually packed up and left in the middle of the night, I think, you know. And
wow.
like Caesar asked me like 3 years later, why did Reuben leave? And I said, damned if I know, you know. But I think part of it for Reuben is that he put Caesar on such a pedestal. He mm-hmm. idealized him
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
that when he started living at La Paz and seeing the everyday nitty-gritty
mm.
of people's relationships, these were things that he really didn't want to be aware of.
Mm.
And I think it was very painful for him because there was something Caesar and I talked about a lot, about he didn't want people to put him on that pedestal, that he could not live up to their expectations of him. He couldn't even know what their expectations were. And he felt that their focus was misdirected by aiming it at him. And I think this happened to a lot of people, especially people who came to visit on the Friday night things. It happened to me when I left the union,
mm-hmm.
and I was first back. I mean, I had so many friends, you wouldn't believe, you know, and I eventually had to back off and focus on my family because it got so I didn't know who was being real with me. And it wow. dawned on me what was going on there is that people who never got to know him or Dolores or anyone else, somehow it made them feel good and important to say that they knew someone who knew them. And so you found yourself being used in ways that you didn't want. And I wish I'd had the tools then to set boundaries for myself that I have now,
mm-hmm.
Because it became very painful for me to realize mm-hmm. that was why people were being nice to me.
Right.
When I came back, I was on welfare, and I had this beat up car, but I still wanted to contribute, and so I would take farm workers that came up to help register voters, and I was taking them down to Morgan Hill and Gilroy to register people. And at the end of that campaign, which may have been the No on 22 campaign, they kept telling me, you know, well, you know, Caesar's going to be in San Francisco Friday night, and we want you to go with us. And I said, oh, yeah, I haven't seen you since I left La Paz. You know, I'd love to go. There was a new guy running the boycott office in San Jose who didn't care and didn't know who I was, you know. And I hadn't been out on any of his picket lines. I'd only worked in this capacity. And he flat out told me to my face, you can't go because you're not staff. And I said, fine, don't call me again.
Mm.
And I went home. Reuben was staying at my house that weekend because he had driven volunteers up from the valley to work in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he came home, you know, he said he was going down to a meeting. You know, did I want to go down there? And this is like a week or so later, and I said no. And I told him why, and
mm-hmm.
he was just livid.
Mm.
And it's one time he really stuck up for me. He
mm-hmm.
went down there, and he really ripped that guy up. And he said, you know, there are no differentiations between people
mm-hmm.
within this union as long as I'm in it. Who are you to say that you are staff? Does that make you better
mm-hmm.
than the person that goes out and registers people to vote, who goes out on picket lines? Who the hell do you think you are? Do you know who you said that to? You know, and he says, don't ever call her again. Don't ever bother her again. Monday morning, I got a phone call. Could you drive so-and-so somewhere? And I said, fuck you. And I hung up the phone. And that was the end of it.
Yeah,
you know, from then on, I knew that my
you.
Focus had to be my kids at that point,
okay.
and getting my life on track and getting a job
mm-hmm.
and taking care of us. I mean, I was using my welfare money for gas instead of food for my kids, you know?
Oh, mm-hmm.
You know, to get to be insulted, you mm. know? And but, you know, I began to realize, because as I became more, I couldn't even read a newspaper. I hadn't seen, allowed myself to read a newspaper ad for years because I had no money to buy anything. And so I'm starting to become more urbanized, and I went up to the liquor store to cash a check that I had gotten for support, you know, from the Union for the Kids. I got $50 a month for my children. And there was a picket line at Safeway. And the pickets, my girlfriend was with me, and she really resented the union for, you know, what I had gone through, and she just mm-hmm. thought it was really unfair, and mm-hmm. I kept trying to explain to her that it wasn't unfair, it was my choice. We get out of the car, and we were literally accosted by the pickets, and I explained to them, I'm not going into Safeway, I don't trade with Safeway, I support the union, I'm going into the liquor store next door to cash my check.
Mm-hmm.
And I was verbally attacked and very nearly physically attacked by this person. And Betty, bless her heart, little quiet Betty stood up and said, just matter in a wet hen, and really ripped this guy up, you know. And again said, I don't think you know who you're talking to here, you know, and blah, 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 blah. But it was a good lesson to me because I realized, number one, it was time for me to back off.
Mm-hmm.
It was time for people who were newly turned on to the cause mm-hmm. to have their chance mm-hmm. to make mm-hmm. their contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really idiotic of me to think that they should know what my contribution had been, you know. And that was an unrealistic expectation. And that
on the other hand, they assumed a lot.
Yeah, but again,
even if you hadn't made this contribution, and were just someone.
Yeah, they were militant in a much more negative way. I mean,
yes.
We were militant,
yes.
But God, I was such a picket line Mary. There was a guy named Joe Graham who was a member of the Communist Party and who was some official in the Railroad Workers Union
mm-hmm.
who had been very, very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
of the boycott office, and we were out on a picket line at Joy Frankel's PW on about 16th and Alum Rock
mm-hmm.
in San Jose, and I was crossing the driveway, and all of a sudden somebody pushed me hard,
mm-hmm.
and I turned around, and it was Joe, and this man had tried to run me down with his truck. I would be a salesperson right now if it wasn't for Joe Graham. You know, and this guy came barreling out of the store, and I walked right up. I mean, I had more guts and sense, you know, but you had this sense of righteousness,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
and I walked up to this truck, and I was writing down his license number, and the guy came out of the store, and he just went ballistic, you know, and what are you going to do? And I said, I've got your license number. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Hit me, you know. You tried to kill me. You know, and you know, he was peppering us with grapes, and people did
mm-hmm.
that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We had a black man come out to the picket line where we were being harassed by the cops at the Lucky Store of 7th and Santa Clara, and he started arguing with one of the pickets, and he came back a little bit later with a gun and started shooting at us, you know. And we had to beg the cops to arrest him. There was the cops in the very beginning would come out, and they were so intimidating, and they were you know, they were as bad as the people who threw grapes on us,
mm-hmm.
you know,
really bad.
So at Joy Franco's, I remember I always carried a camera, or Ruben did, and we took pictures of the cops. And I mean, you talk about having, it wasn't even balls, I mean, it was dumb, naive stupidity. Liz Rodriguez and I marched into Chief Blackwell's office on Monday morning. Chief Blackwell was a political animal in San Jose that went way back,
mm-hmm.
you know. He was very conservative. He was very anti-union, very